Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Hugo's There podcast panel discussion on Hugo nominees. This time, we're going to be talking about the novelettes for the 2021 Hugo Awards. This will come out on audio in my podcast feed. It's also going to end up on video on my Patreon page as a public post and on my YouTube channel. And I do want to give a shout out. I actually, pardon me, have a subscriber on YouTube now. So hi, Kristen L, who is a booktuber, has done a lot more stuff on YouTube than I have. And actually she focuses on awards. So she has her favorites for the Hugo Awards going several years. So, right. Anyhow, this time I've got a couple of repeat guests from last time. So we have Ivor over in Scotland. Hi, Ivor. And we have Sarah on the East Coast of the United States. What, Carolinas?
From Carolinas, now in Maryland.
Gotcha. Okay. And then we have Cora from Germany. So guten Abend. Guten Nachmittag.
Guten Abend.
And then we have a couple new faces. So from Canada, we have Olav. So hi, Olav. Say hello.
Hello.
Anything people should know about you? 30-second dossier.
On the Hugo ballot this year in the fanzine category, along with my partner, Amanda, we, our blog, the Hugo_book_club on Twitter blog, is on the ballot this year. And thank you, Cora, for profiling us.
Yes.
You're very welcome. I'm always happy to profile any good fanzine, blog, podcast, semi-prozine.
And then we have in Florida, we have Juan. Hey, Juan.
Hello there. Nothing to plug right now. I'm at liberty podcast wise, but you can catch me on Twitter. Just look either Juan San Miguel or Rainbow Warrior 71 and you should find me.
Cool. All right. That's all we need to do, I think, for intros this time. So let's see. We were going to have a couple other guests, but I don't need to introduce them. So does anybody know what the definition of a novelette is?
Yes. Anything between 7,000 and 17,500 words.
Okay.
Correct me if I'm wrong if I got it.
It's actually 7,500 to 17,500 words. A bit weird. Oh, yeah. I don't know why they have this weird 500, but that's just the definition according to Nebula and Hugo rules. And also the one that a lot of writers use.
Okay. Sounds good. All right. So let me run down the list of novelettes that we're going to be talking about, and then we will we've got a recapper for each story, and we'll do that. So we have Monster by Naaman Pritzker, which was published in Clark's World, and then we have Burn, or the Episodic Life of Sam Wells as a Super, by A.T. Greenblatt, which was published in Uncanny Magazine. We have A Helicopter Story by Isabel Fall, published in Clark's World. Then we have The Inaccessibility of Heaven by Elliot de Baudard, published by Uncanny. And The Pill by Meg Ellison from Big Girl PM Press. And Two Truths and a Lie by Sarah Pinsker. I want to say Pinkser for some reason. Published on Tor.com. So we're going to go through them, I think, in that order. Yes, we are. So why don't we go ahead and start with Monster. And
We're going to start with Attack Helicopter since Sarah has a hard limit.
Yes, good point. We're going to do that because Sarah's probably going to have to leave us before we finish. So let's start with Helicopter Story. And Sarah, you are our recapper for that.
Thanks. Yes, we'll see how the time is going for me for when I have to drop out. So let me pull up my recap. All right. So I read I Sexually Identify as an Attack Helicopter by when it was originally published in Clark's World magazine in January 2020. First, the plot and characters. We learn right at the beginning that Barb is all in on the U.S. Army's reassignment of their gender to better perform their tactical role as an attack helicopter pilot, going beyond the Army's neurosurgery to tie their drives to fulfilling the mission. Barb and their gunner Axis are sent to strike a high school in enemy territory, what was once Nevada, California. On their way back, they get into an exciting aerial dogfight, illustrating their teamwork and Barb's joy in who they are. Barb doesn't care about the war or the deaths it causes, not that much. Barb likes to fly, feel the wind, inflict damage, and manage their violent internal forces well because it makes them feel right. As the story says, a helicopter is propelled by its interior near disaster. But their partner Axis is questioning the mission and their future. And to Barb, this means questioning their partnership and their identity. So Barb also in this story aggressively shares their own reflections on gender, sexuality, neuromapping, societal pressures, and Army psychology throughout their retelling of the strike and return to base.
Wow. I can just say that the when I do a recap, it's not going to be that thorough.
Sorry.
No worries. No, that's very good. This is one where the history of the publication of the story is kind of as interesting as the actual story itself. So anybody else who wants to talk about it, go ahead and take it away.
I have other things to say if okay. We're waiting for, and maybe something else I'll say will prompt other discussion.
Sure.
Unless, okay. All right.
Well, Juan had sent out a link to a Vox article and a podcast about with the author of that Vox article about this story that was interesting. So Juan, I didn't know if you wanted to say something.
Well, no, I sent that. It's more about the publication of the story.
Yeah.
And all the controversy. And I think that could be, I wanted that in the show notes in case. I mean, personally, I thought, I'm not sure if I read it when it first came out and before it was pulled, but I was intrigued by it. It seemed to be like an interesting SF story dealing with the issue with trans issues, gender issues. And I thought, and also, you know, has some interesting technological stuff. And I thought it was a very interesting mm-hmm. story.
Yeah.
Court, so I wanted to say the story had a lot of information compressed in it.
Yes.
There are pings between Barb and Axis, which was interesting. I'll stop now because I see Cora has her hand up and I want to hear what she has to say.
Well, like Sarah, I also reread this story when it almost directly after it came out in Clark's World, very early in January. This story and Monster were in the same issue of Clark's World, actually. I read Monster because I like Naomi Kritzer's work and liked Monster a whole lot. And then I read then I was intrigued by the title of this one. Well, I said, okay, that's an interesting title. Let's see. And I'm sorry to say it just didn't work. I can see what the author was trying to do to show the dysphoria, but it just didn't work for me. And I initially thought like dismissed it like, okay, this story doesn't work for me. I'm not sure what to think of it. And then about 1 week later, all hell literally broke loose. Loose in the internet fell on Isabel Fall's head, and people made all sorts of ridiculous ideas like this: is this a joke, or is someone trying to trick Clark's World? And all sorts of conjectures about the author, most of which were completely ridiculous because the story is 10,000 words long. No one writes 10,000 words as a joke. Mm-hmm. Also, it was pretty obviously that it was supposed to be that it was serious. Series, it just didn't work. And then it was pulled, and then later that Vox article came out. And so I didn't. And then was Hugo nominated. And actually, I read it again or skimmed it because originally I was thought like, okay, I don't like that one. I'm not going to vote for it. So, but I said, okay, let's be fair. You're on the panel. Let's take a look. And I'm sorry, but it still doesn't work for me. I can see what she's trying to do. Isabel Fall is trying to do. I can see that she's trying to feel the dysphoria and everything. But it's just maybe it's just because dysphoria is not something I have a lot of experience with because I've usually felt good in my own skin. For example, there's this bit where Barb thinks about pubic hair and hair growth and how it made them feel when they were still human. And I thought like, okay, I have quite heavy hair growth too. And I know it's not socially accepted, but for me, it was like, just like, okay, I don't care. So maybe it's just that the story doesn't work for me. One thing I did like were all the technical details about helicopters. It was clearly a very good story about a helicopter. It's just that it didn't quite work for me. Okay, and now I think Olaf wanted to say something.
Well, I read it before the whole controversy erupted, and it didn't speak to me. But then I read it, and I sort of knew, yeah, this wasn't written for me. This is a story for a very specific audience, of which I'm not a member, and that's fine. I think enough people in the sci-fi community do feel like that is that it speaks to them. So I don't have a problem with its artistry. It just, it doesn't speak to me. And that's, as I say, okay. I was surprised by the controversy. I was surprised people were so angry at the story.
Go ahead, Sarah.
So the other thing I wanted to talk about in the information compression in the story is there are also a lot of bits that are just sprinkled through about the physical and political terrain of the future that are really kind of revealed as throwaways. And to me, that shows the voice of the narrator is so embedded in the story. It's not stopping to pull out and give you full context. But for instance, we learn the army also did gene therapy to make Barb's blood toxic to mosquitoes, since with climate changes, malaria is now rampant in the U.S. And this is really just kind of a blip in her conversation that she passes along that the, you know, she's assuming that the audience who's there already understands about the Hudson floodplain and that there is now one Great Lake. You know, to me, the story and the storytelling coupled very well, because to me, she's kind of defensive about some things, but very aggressive because that's how she handles everything. And so that's why she has these ranty monologues about gender and so on. And so it's certainly not the most pleasant reading. And you know, there's things I agreed with and disagreed with and what she had to say. But, you know, to me, it ties in very well with her whole, their whole personality, Barb's personality. And so I certainly would agree this story is not for everyone. And I agree that some people can read it as not the best storytelling. For me, it all integrated pretty well from the way I was reading the story.
Yeah, I'd say with this one, the things that worked here are the fact that it is not written for me. And it let me kind of get inside somebody else's head and kind of start to understand some bits about not feeling natural in your own skin and feeling othered by other people. So yeah, I enjoyed it. But I'll definitely encourage people to check out the Vox article. I'll put it in the show notes and in the video description. So if people want to read that or listen to the podcast discussion about it, the article is definitely worth reading. It's quite long. Any other questions or topics or discussion points on this one? No? Okay, we can go ahead and move on. I'll just go ahead.
Sorry, I was just taking a moment to unmute myself because there's noise in the background here.
Gotcha.
I do think over at Nerds of a Feather, one of their commenters made a very good point in their rundown of novelettes, which was that in many ways, the conversation about Helicopter's story has been too much about the controversy, and that refusing to engage with it, the work does a disservice to Isabel Fall and to the people who voted for it. So I do just want to raise one question about the artistry of this. I almost feel like it is somewhere halfway between magical realism and more standard science fiction, because you never know quite where the metaphor ends and where the reality of the story begins, where the helicopters signify transness or where they signify the military-industrial complex. And I do think that is an interesting choice. And I think there is some really clever stuff going on here. So I don't want to dismiss this story or to focus too much on the controversy.
Sure, makes sense. Cora, go ahead.
Well, I mean, the U.S. military in the story is literally weaponized gender. Gender is a weapon now. Your gender can be, in this case, an attack helicopter weapon. Of course, gender and gender norms are used as a weapon against trans people, but also against LGBTQ people in general and against anybody who doesn't conform to fairly arbitrary gender norms. And I also feel, as someone who's not from the U.S., I feel that actually the gender... double gender policing is worse in the U.S. than it's in Germany, because a lot of things, all of this, for example, body hair, women shaving off your body hair, this was something that was not done in Germany at all until the 1990s, and it came in from the U.S. My American cousins shaved their legs, and I was like, I've never seen a woman shave their legs, and maybe a dancer would have done it, but not a, my mother never shaved her legs or something. She shaved her armpits, but that was all. And also, it was simply wasn't also the fact that everybody in America, in the US, every woman, everybody from like age 12 wears a bra all the time. I still don't wear a bra a lot of the time. I wear one when I'm as a Hugo's in an evening gown or something, but not regularly. So gender is a lot more weaponized in the US than it ever, than also it always was. When I was in the US when I was 5 years old, and I had my hair very, very cut, very short. Short because, well, it was practical. My parents liked it. I didn't like it. And I was constantly and I was wearing pants because, again, they were practical and the 70s were more unisex time. And I hated it. I was always mistaken for a boy in the US, more so than in Germany. And I really hated it. And then also at one point I said, okay, I'm going to wear dresses now. I want to, and also I'm going to have my hair long. I don't want to be mistaken for a boy anymore. And you see, I still have wear it long. So, okay, maybe that was my bit of dysphoria moment. But okay, this is a thing I can understand. Gender is often weaponized, and it seems to me to be worse in the US than it is in, at least in Germany. I can't speak for the rest. I mean, the UK has a lot of transphobia issues at the moment with the whole, oh my God, trans people might be in the bathroom. I think like, okay, and why do you care? They have to go some, of course they're in the bathroom. They have to go somewhere. Okay, so yeah, that's my take here.
Okay, Sarah.
So with the gender, definitely I can believe, to me it seemed all science fiction, not magic realism, just, you know, how it struck me, because I can completely believe that if the U.S. Army could figure out a way to tie gender drives into people to be better at their function, I believe they would. And it doesn't seem that unrealistic to me that they could be doing things with hormones and other chemicals to make that happen. There was clearly in the story a lot of psychological work being done on the candidates before they were, you know, before their gender was reassigned with the chemicals. And however, you know, it's a little hand wavy on exactly how it worked, but it seemed there was, the Army was doing psychology and biochemistry to make it happen. And the narrator's point of view is gender is so instinctive. You know, if you're flying and you're not having to process every little thing because it's kind of tied into all your internal drives, specifically gender, to how you feel about who you are, what your identity is. You don't make these mistakes because that would be like... and she makes analogs to a lot of gender stereotype behavior that people, many women, don't want to do, for instance, because they don't want to be interpreted as not being right. You know, Barb wants to feel right. On the haircutting thing, I know several women who specifically keep their hair short all the time because they don't want to attract, they want to repel guys who insist on women having long hair, because for them that's tied in with a lot of male chauvinism attitude. And if they cut their hair short, they never have to worry that you know, they're going to be attracting the wrong guy. I mean, I know there's also power dynamics in dating and blah blah blah, but you know, so all right, I'll stop.
Okay. Ivor, go ahead.
I'm going to, first of all, to Cora, just to say that as a child of the 70s, if I had to get the bath water off my mum, I can guarantee she shaved her legs. that was the thing. You got the bath water off the last person in it. But on the point of view of, I'm a reader, you know, and I looked at this along the lines of basically, I heard the story on the podcast, I believe, and along the lines, it's an augmentation, human augmentation story, with fluid identity wrapped up in a kind of military sci-fi wrapper. As a reader, it was no great shakes. As the concepts go, I've read some of these elsewhere, and maybe I'm naive or maybe progressive, but I think gender will be fluid. And it's something that science fiction and other writing kind of brings in to say these are things we had to consider as readers. So it wasn't a great story, but concepts are interesting.
All right. Anything else anybody wants to comment on this one? Sarah, give us a wave before, you know, if we hit your hard stop, give us a wave. I want to make sure you can, you know, say something before you go. All right. Let's go ahead and move on to Monster by Naomi Kritzer. So, Cora, you have recapping duties on that one.
Okay. So, the story alternates between present-day scenes set in a rural part of China, the village. I'm probably really butchering the pronunciation now. I should have asked this Chinese friend. The village is called Danzai, and it's in Guiyang province in China, a very, very rural and remote area. And the narrator, a woman called Cicely, is arriving in this part of China where absolutely no one speaks English, and she's looking for someone, an old friend named Andrew. And interspersed with the present-day China scenes, we get basically the history of Cecily's and Andrew's friendship. And Cecily was a geek girl and also a bit of a tomboy and maybe on the autism spectrum because she has sensory issues, which aren't just an autism spectrum thing, but might be. And she's a geeky, doesn't get along with the other girls because she's also not performing gender right, but she befriends this boy, Andrew. Andrew, they bond over science fiction novels. And Andrew, it turns out, is something of a budding mad scientist. They're both science geeks, but something is a bit strange about Andrew. Andrew, his girlfriend, tries to warn Cecily about him, and Andrew is just... then Andrew and Cecily, they go off to different colleges. Cecily excels at school. Andrew is very smart, but doesn't do well at school simply because he doesn't care, doesn't go to as good a university, and they eventually break up and don't see each other for 20 years until they meet again on Facebook. And Cecily is now a genetics researcher working with CRISPR, and she's written a seminal paper. And Andrew asks her to send him the paper, which she does because, hey, he's her friend. And then a bit later, the FBI shows up in front of her door because Andrew has been doing experiments on homeless teenagers, and he's apparently trying to develop some kind of Jekyll and Hyde serum because Andrew was bullied badly and wanted to take revenge and wanted to be strong, and now he's giving it to other teenagers who are dying. And he took his own serum, he took out a bunch of agents sent to arrest him, and then fled to China. And Cecily is supposed to, hand him in because, the CIA and the US military, being the bastards we know from the helicopter story, and it's kind of fitting that they were both in the same issue, want the serum for themselves. But Cecily has other ideas. There's also a subplot about an MI6 agent who's also trying to apprehend Andrew and gets killed by him. Cecily finds Andrew, and because she's, of course, also a great genetic engineer, she slips him bacteria, which is genetically engineered, or virus, only to work on people who've had this Jekyll and Hyde serum, which Andrew has taken, and she kills him, even though he's her best friend, because, he has literally become a monster.
Yeah, this one, for me, it felt like I thought this one would work better as a full novel or as a novella, something longer. There was something about it that just felt underdeveloped, where we rushed to the conclusion of it, and it didn't make much of an impact on me. I did enjoy, like you said, Cora, the tie-ins with Helicopter Story about the military wanting to take this super serum and use it for themselves, and that Cecily didn't want that to happen. Didn't really go anywhere for me. That's okay. Go ahead, Sarah.
So for me, the length worked. It reminded me in a lot of ways of an old Kate Wilhelm story called Windsong, where it's kind of an inverse of the story. In Windsong, very quickly, some teenagers are friends, and one of them, a girl, is really good at figuring out which beach house the owners aren't at so they can use the beach in front of that beach house. She's got really good skills at subliminals, but she doesn't want to date this guy. And years later, this guy in the army they need to make their tanks better. They need AI and they need a brain that's really good at subliminals. And he fingers her to the army. And the implication in the story is, you know, she's dead at the end because the army wanted to slurp her brains up into making a better tank. Mm-hmm. And that was a horror story. And to me, it was a real relief to read this story. You know, I started thinking about it because you've got these awkward teenage, you know, really smart people things in both stories. And to me, it just kind of flipped things on its head. And it was a relief to read, you know, the girl surviving. And I'm not saying Kritzer read that story, but for me, they came together really fast. I thought the links were comparable. It just all kind of worked for me. Whether that's at all what the author was doing, that's how it worked for me.
I was going to compare it to Windsong as well. You're absolutely right. I think I read that in one of those yellow and hardcover anthologies. That's such a great story. And you know, I think Monster is going to end up pretty high on my ballot.
Okay.
I really like how Kritzer writes. I find her prose incredibly clear and concise and engaging. She gives me characters that I want to follow. And, you know, right off the bat with this one, you know, this protagonist has a narrative voice, and they're at that airport, and you sort of get who she is very quickly, and all of the references to old sci-fi novels. Okay, I am a sucker for that. I fully admit that the moment you're throwing in, a reference to the main character enjoying Neuromancer and all of this, I'm. You know what? I'm a simple man of simple tastes, and I like clear prose that's nice and fun to read. And yeah, I would have 100% been on board with this one being longer. I would have wanted a novella, a novella or even a novel of this. I'm on board.
Nice. Go ahead, Juan.
Oh, okay. No, I think this I think this is the right size. It didn't leave me wanting more. I mean, one of the things that annoys me in the short category is the fact that there's some works that, you know, will be part of a larger work sometime down the future. And this just felt right. Also, I want to – this is one of two of the finalists, which were actually also podcasts. I originally listened to this as a podcast on Clark's World, and you know, I was listening to it on a walk, and I thought it was very well paced. It was very, you got into the characters. It was just very straightforward and got to the point. Clever ending. So I think that I think it's the perfect length and did all that it needed to do.
Mm. Most of these work well as a podcast.
Yeah,
I'll have to listen to that.
I have it downloaded. I wanted to listen to it because I didn't get to review this one. I read, it was one of the first ones that I read, and then I didn't get to double back to it. So maybe I'll give that one another listen. Go ahead, Cora.
Well, this was actually the first every year I have a list of when I'm Hugo nominator and voter. I have a list of stories, films, novels, anything which catches my eye over the year, it goes on the list. And this was the first story which went on my list for 2020. And it was because it came out really early. It was January. It was I think maybe 2nd or 3rd January. It was like, okay, I have a list already because I liked this story so much. And Olaf also, I'm a big fan of Naomi Kritzer's work. Well, she's just a writer who works for me and who clicks with me. And I liked this one. I liked, yes, the 1980s awkward teenagers and science fiction references. I mean, the books she reads, like, McCaffrey, Asimov, those were the same authors I read at the time. What's the third one? I think Clark or Heinlein. And then Neuromancer, and the movies they watched, Alien and so on. Those were simply, it was pretty much much my teenage years, except that I didn't have a down to dissecting frogs and the, no, we didn't do a frog, we did, it was a was an eyeball of a cow or something, I think. But we also did this dissecting in school, and half the students got sick and so on. So yeah, it was pretty much my teenage years, except that I didn't have the geeky awkward male friends, but none of them turned out to be a mad scientist. Thank heavens. So this was something which clicked with me, and also loved the atmospheric descriptions of very rural China, which is not the glitzy modern China we see like, oh, China, the rising power. This is just a very rural area and so on. And I liked those descriptions a lot. They felt very, also wondered whether Naomi Kritzer had actually visited this part of China, because I think this is not an area you would describe if you didn't know it, simply because it's apparently very remote, very obscure. And finally, I liked the, I haven't read Windsong. Obviously, he will have to remedy it and read it as soon as possible. But for me, this was basically, it's pretty much Jekyll and Hyde, or take on Jekyll and Hyde, or the people who hunt him down, except that this one shows that, yeah, Hyde is not really Jekyll was always a monster. He didn't just become a monster once he became Hyde, which is something that Stevenson doesn't really bring out. Some of the movies do. A lot of the movies also don't bring it out and turn Jekyll into this really, really noble guy. And so, yes, I like this one a lot, and it will end up fairly high on my ballot.
Okay, Sarah?
For anyone who does want to read Windsong, it's in Kate Wilhelm's collection, The Abyss, and Joachim Baus covered that in SF Ruminations in his blog. He's done several Kate Wilhelm books. So if people want to read more about it before they try and hunt it down, that's a place to look.
Okay. Thank you for that. Ivor?
I'm going to be the opposite. I really enjoy the travel elements of it, the features of China, etc. And I found the story just a wee bit lacking. I wanted to know why he was killing people. I wanted to know why it didn't go on or how it started. I just am more enjoyed about what's happening in China, what she was seeing. So again, different view, and that's the way I felt about it.
All right, Juan?
To counter Eve, I thought they did define the why. I thought he wanted to make people better, wanted to make people not bullied, or, you know, improvement to the species, giving them, I mean, I thought he rationalized what he was doing as an experiment, that they would be stronger, better, and they wouldn't be victims anymore. At least that's what my take was.
Hmm. Cora, something else?
Yeah, I also viewed his experiments as a reaction to the bullying that he and also Cecily and others received as children. I mean, that happens to a lot of kids in general, getting bullied at school, and especially the smart, geeky kids get bullied at school a lot. And Andrew simply, well, something was always wrong with him, apparently, and he just snapped and then decided to. I mean, there's also this long episode where some kind of football player, and they wanted to, he does something mean, and they want to take revenge on him. And Cecily, I think, he just knocks her. She knocks her lunch tray into his face, which is okay. That's the sort of thing that teenagers and children do, perfectly harmless. But Andrew goes further. He burns down this guy's car, which is, of course, no longer perfectly harmless. So I think it is integrated into the story, so it might get a bit lost among the general teenage experience things. But he wants to. He also says at one point, "I wanted to help the people who need help, and to me to be strong." He didn't. He says he didn't take homeless teenagers because they were easy to get. Okay, he rationalizes it. Of course, he took them because they were easy to get, but also because those were kids, abused kids who needed help and needed to be strong. Andrew has very good rationalizations for what he does. Of course, it doesn't excuse anything. He still creates a serum which kills a lot of the people that use it, and he also kills a bunch of FBI agents who. Which, okay, the FBI and the CIA aren't the good guys here, but it's still not okay to just kill them.
Yeah. Ivor, Juan, I see you both got your hands up.
I'll defer to Ivor.
Okay. You defer to me? Okay, that's fine. I'm going for Mr. Unpopularity here. But I think the trope's been well used about, you know, being bullied at school and various other books. It's nothing new. I homeless people. Sorry, there's a cat claw in my arm. Apologies. You know, homeless people, they're not always victims. They're actually some of the strongest people, you know. I just felt it was weak. I wanted to know, he's killing people to make them stronger. That's the bit I want to know about. How does he reconcile that with himself? So, again, maybe in the novel it would be a lot better, but again, just enjoyed the landscape as it went through.
Yeah. I was kind of thinking of that while Cora was talking about, like, American foreign policy and going in, intervening in places and ending up turning them worse. And that kind of reminds me of, you know, experimenting on people who you're trying to make stronger and end up killing them.
I don't think it was Andrew's intention that these people were going to die. He was confident in his research that they were going to live. My thing is just a quick thing on structure. I thought this was a great buildup. As I said, I first listened to this story and then reread it for this podcast. But I thought it was a great buildup because she's going to China. You don't really know why she's going to China at the beginning, and then you do the flashback. So it's a very good buildup, and that's where it hits you that, you know, Andrew, you know, now she's got to fight her best friend or her closest friend she's ever had. So I even though, and it didn't sprinkle because you do have that one incident in the restaurant where she bumps in to his ex-girlfriend and kind of drops suggestion that there's something not right. And this is at the point where they've split up because they're both in college. So I thought that gradual buildup, great in structure.
Yeah. And, you know, we don't have to agree on the stories. That's the point of
having
one person, right? So anything else on this one? Sarah?
Yes. For the buildup, yeah, he thought he was so great in high school. He was too good to do the homework, et cetera. And then he didn't get into college. And, you know, to me, the path worked pretty well. You know, lots of people don't grow up to go back and torture their high school bullies or whatever. You know, lots of us get over it and move on and maybe have some scars. But, you know, we don't all become serial mad scientist killer people. But for me, you know, the minute she was talking about this guy who was too good to do things and then resentful because his genius wasn't recognized, I know those guys, you know.
Yeah.
That tracked pretty well for me. And I, you know, it was very believable to me.
Yeah.
I think we all know those guys, and some of us may have met them in high school. They were too brilliant. I was the person from whom everybody copied their homework because I let them do it. And I did my homework. Sometimes I did it in class, or I did it during the breaks because, okay, and I didn't like it, but I liked it because it was like, okay, I understood this the first time around. Why am I doing this the third time? But I still did it because he was supposed to do it. And yeah, I also knew the ones who wouldn't do it. None of them, thankfully, became, as far as I know, a mad scientist. And also, yeah, the high school bullying. No, after some time, you get over it. Interestingly, the only person from my high school I'm still angry at, and I'm glad never ran into again, was one of the teachers who just say, well, didn't stop the bullying of a boy who was my friend, my Andrew. He didn't stop. He basically joined in the bullying of my Andrew. And he's not, don't worry, my Andrew is not a mad scientist. He became a lawyer and he's doing well and he's fine. But this is the only person I'm still angry at. I'm not angry at the other kids anymore. They were kids and it's fine. And when I see some of them, it's like, oh, hi, how are you doing? What are you doing? I don't go to the reunions. I thought, okay, maybe if I have a Hugo to show, I might go, but then think, okay, won't mean anything to them. It's just, okay, what's your job? What's your house? So, okay, but we get over it. Andrew is the kind of person who, well, doesn't get over it. Also, even this teacher, no, I wouldn't kill him and do anything bad to him. I would just tell him, like, okay, sorry, but you were a terrible teacher. Mm-hmm.
All right. Any other final thoughts on this one, or shall we move on? Go ahead, Ivor.
I was going to say, Cora, he's become a lawyer. That's worse than a mad scientist.
Nice. All right. Why don't we go ahead and move on to Burn, or the episodic life of Sam Wells as a super. I unfortunately am on the hook for the recap on this one, and I didn't write anything down. So off the top of my head, Sam Wells is in a world where supers are common and not super well regarded. Sam is attempting to join a superhero team who kind of reluctantly take him in, kind of a B-list superhero team, really. And Sam just really wants to help people. And he finds out that his skills as an accountant are more useful than his skills as a super on account of he has pyrokinesis. And so, you know, his hair will light on fire, his hands light on fire. And there was a famous incident where he kind of almost burned down a bar because his powers manifested. So if anybody else wants to jump in and say what the rest of the story was about, go for it. I feel like there's definitely a metaphor for trying to fit in with a certain crowd and then finding that that certain crowd isn't necessarily ideal, but is the same kind of broken as you. There might have been a metaphor there for nerd culture. Go ahead, Juan.
One thing you mentioned is that unstable people with meta powers are isolated. They're sent off into the country or something where they can't harm, and that's Sam's fate if he can't get it with a super group. So I like the story. I mean, again, this is the other story, which is an audio story. It's a podcast on Uncanny. That's how I listened. Actually, I had to listen to it three times. For some reason, I was zoning out, and I think that was just my state of mind at that point when I was listening to it. But it was a very good story. It's about a guy trying to find his place in the world. And the supers are initially antagonistic towards him, but he eventually works and finds out, hey, this is my thing. This is the thing I can do, and eventually finds his own.
Yeah. Go ahead, Cora.
Well, also, Sam does get to be the hero in the end, because he does. Then the superheroes, they have a team headquarters, but it's just an old community center. It's not something cool like a volcano lair or the X-Men's mansion or something like that. And some anti-mutant or anti-super activist tries to burn it down, and he runs in because one of their team janitor, the woman who's mute, is still in there, and he runs in to save, and he thinks she's in there. She's not in there, but Sam survives because he's because of his pyrokinetic powers, and so he does get to be the hero. Also, Sam, all of these people were also outsiders, let's just say, even before they were marginalized, even before they got superpowers. Sam is gay, and he has a sort of relationship where he's in love with one of his teammates, a guy called Cyrus, who's Mr. Sunshine, who's basically their Superman. Or no, Sunshine is more like Apollo from the Authority. There's this mute woman, and it's quite obvious that these people were oddballs and marginalized even before they manifested superpowers. And, well, I really liked the story. It felt to me like it was a more realistic X-Men. It was basically X-Men, the mutants who only want to, or the supers who only want to help people, are being ostracized and hated and feared and... it doesn't really work out as well for them as it does for the X-Men, but they do find their place, they find their team, they find friends, and that's great. And yeah, as a long-time X-Men reader, I really liked this aspect of the story.
And in terms of structure, the story is, you know, it is called the episodic life, right? Because it is just, you know, a little slice of life kind of through his initial move into the team and then through this first major event. Go ahead, Sarah.
Yeah, I'm a longtime X-Men reader. I had 93 through 193 unbroken at one time. But it actually reminded me a little more of The Tick. I enjoyed the animated TV series, and there are some kind of goofball superheroes on that team that I enjoyed. The other thing this book reminds me a little of is the Fred the Vampire Accountant series by Drew Charles, where there actually is a fair bit of accounting in the books. There's also vampires and werewolves and all this stuff. I enjoy stories about people who are organizing things, and that is one of the things that that the hero of this story does. You know, he's helping this superhero team get on top of their finances and their organization. And I just I enjoyed that aspect of it. I wouldn't have minded more accounting in the story.
I agree. And, you know, one of the things that superhero stories can be done, used to do well, is to contrast mundanity with the extreme. So this actually, in a strange way, reminded me of the TV series Loki, because you have this completely bizarre setup, and then you've got the day-to-day bureaucracy of it. And I think that's actually something Greenblatt did quite well here, both in terms of the Quatodian prose, and also in terms of the transitions. But those switches between the episodes allow the writer to really vary the tone. I'm not a fan of superheroes in prose works, but this mostly worked for me.
Okay. Juan, do you have something to say?
Oh, just a quick thing. That was a whole selling point of Marvel. The mundane with the extraordinary. I mean, that was their whole selling point. That's the only thing I wanted to mention. So this story got that right.
Go ahead, Cora.
Yeah. I also like the fact that it actually does, because most superhero teams, even the more realistic ones from Marvel, they're all independently wealthy. The Avengers are bankrolled by Tony Stark, who has more money than God. The Justice League is probably bankrolled by Bruce Wayne, who also has more money than God, and both of them never really work in their jobs, but they're still filthy rich. The X-Men, I suppose they're probably bankrolled by Professor Xavier, and he's also apparently he has generational wealth and so on. And there are some, Spider-Man occasionally has financial issues. One of the Superman movies, the family farm had to be foreclosed, but Superman, of course, has a job as a reporter. He isn't doing too badly. But Spider-Man really does have some issues. But even the realistic Marvel, let's say more realistic. They're not really realistic, but Marvel is more down to earth than DC and has always been. I mean, even those more down to earth Marvel comics don't usually care about the finances. And here they don't have money for a grade. They have this old community center. They're not even on top of the paperwork. Their whole basement is a mess, and Sam is just about to really get through it and maybe get some money. And he also has a podcast, which is great, with this other superhero woman, Miranda. They have a podcast about money investment tips for superheroes, which is, that's lovely. I love that idea. And that's an aspect simply I enjoyed, because this is something that the regular superhero comics don't do. Also, like the bar run by a guy who isn't a superhero himself, but who has a sister or niece who's one, and who helps the superheroes because he hopes that the sister or niece will accept herself more when she sees, okay, these are all really normal and good people.
Any other comments on this one? All right, doesn't sound like it. We can go ahead and move on to the inaccessibility of heaven, I think. Is that what we're to?
Oh, okay. So let me get to my notes.
Yeah, Juan, you're the recapper.
Yeah, the inaccessibility from heaven. Actually, I was kind of surprised by this one, because I, in the Hugo packet, and I guess if you can find it on Candy, there was an interview with Alette de Baudard on it. And it turns out, the thing is, she wrote a series of books called The Fallen Angel Story. And this turns out to be adjacent. This is an idea she had. And incorporate, but the novel series and this are different, because the novel series take place in the 19th century in Paris, and this takes place in a city called Star Hollow. So they were kind of adjacent. She wanted to explore ideas, but essentially the story is about a woman by the name of Sam who's holding a place to help angels who are kind of down on their luck. And also, in the two similarities in this world is that angel remains actually have some power to them, and actually has a euphoric effect on people. And so she's requested by this Arvedi, if I'm pronouncing it right, the leader in the angel underworld, to find out there's some mysterious deaths that nobody can account for. And so it becomes a noir. Sam gets involved in mystery. It's essentially a mystery. I don't want to give too much away because, again, this is available on Canny, and you can read it for free. Sadly, not a podcast, but so I don't want to give away the ending. But it's very noirish. It's a great mystery story. I was engaged with it, but I'm a big fan of the two novels that we did, which again are adjacent to it.
Yeah, I was wondering if they were connected, and I looked it up as well and saw that, yeah, they're not a shared universe, but some definite similarities in it. Comments from anybody else on this one? Go ahead, Cora.
Well, I also liked it a lot. First of all, it has really, probably has the best world building, largely because she already had the world from, I think the first one was called something House of Shattered Wings, or at any rate, I have the first of those Fallen Angel books, and I've read it, but it's been a while, so I don't remember a lot about it, except that I liked it. And the world building is really great with all of those angels and the thing. We have a couple of stories here which are also mysteries. The Truth and the Lie, Monster, or which have mystery thriller elements, but this one is the purest, basically it's a murder mystery because they're hunting an angel serial killer. And as so often, the an unexpected person turns out to be the killer in the end. And it also reminded me a lot of the TV series Lucifer, the TV show, and of course it was a comic, but I never read the exact comic. I only read what's the TV show. So with the angels in the running around in the real world and trying to get by or not. And yeah, it's a good story. It really works well, and I think it will feature fairly high on my ballot. Of course, it's also the longest story. It's barely under the novella line.
I think this was not my favorite of the stories, but I think it's de Bodard is one of the best writers around and one of the most I think thoughtful in terms of how she builds her prose. In this one, I almost wondered if she was deliberately mixing in some Chandler-esque noir tropes into the language she was using while switching back to a more standard fantasy style at times. Hmm. Did you guys pick up on that?
I would go for that, yeah.
Yeah, definitely there's some noir here.
I really respect her as a writer and how she thinks about writing.
Hmm. Ivor, go ahead.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoyed this story. However, I must be done a slight phase of reading stuff like this because it kind of had similarities to, again, I can't remember, is it Clark's Gin, the Dead Gin stories? But also, you probably won't know this, I thought it was a direct opposite or kind of version of The Devil's Detective, which was a Simon's Kurt Unsworth novel of a detective in hell researching deaths in hell. Or investigating deaths and tells he was a policeman, and it seemed to have great similarity there. And there was a lot about the fallout from heaven, etc. But from the point of view of writing, it was beautiful, and it is something I've always wanted to read more of her work. And as an introduction, that would just really kind of set me on fire to read more. Hmm.
Sarah, go ahead.
So for me, this didn't work as a standalone. I have loved some of the author's other short stories, and I haven't read the angel stuff. And I could see what she was doing. I could see there was supposed to be emotional impact about the relationship with this other person in the story and so on. You know, I could see it was supposed to be meaningful and resonant and all that, but I didn't find it that way. So I think it will hit different people differently who have not read any of the books that it's in the world of. You know, I could see there was world building and all of that, but for me, it just didn't work as a standalone.
Yeah. For me, this one, It really does just drop you right into the world. And I think it would have been helpful if it was part of a larger series. If I had read it, that might have given some context. I'm not really into urban fantasy. My conservative Christian upbringing makes me suspicious of anything with demons in it. And I really enjoyed this one. I was surprised how much I was pulled into it. I think that was the quality of the prose in it. And I don't know, somehow I got sucked into it. And what you were talking about, Sarah, worked for me. It's just, you never know what somebody's going to like, right? Go ahead, Cora.
Yeah, what Ivar said, that he'd read a lot of things similar. It is very much, I mean, the big urban fantasy boom was about 10 to 12 years ago. We had this huge boom of urban fantasy, which somehow passed both the Hugos and the general science fiction community completely by. And there were a lot of great, and a lot of those urban fantasy series which came out around the time, they did pretty much what Aliette Bodard does here. They mix a supernatural world or sort of like our world with vampires, demons, angels, werewolves, whatever you want. And they used a lot of noir tropes and also and hardball tropes. They used the tropes. A lot of them were also mystery novels, and they also used the hardball noir type language. This feels, it feels pretty much, I mean, the big boom is over, and I read a lot of those books at the time because I was very frustrated with, let's say, the mainstream science fiction. There was all this singularity stuff, which I just didn't work for me, and I didn't like it. So I read a lot of it at the time, and this feels like, okay, yeah, this feels like those books that I read like 10 years ago, and this part also because it's simply a genre and style I like, and I'm not a huge fan. I was never a huge fan of angels, either fallen or not fallen. Fallen, I prefer the well, because the angels, they always have this theological baggage. And yeah, well, I was raised Lutheran, but the sort of North German Lutherans were about the most rational type of Christians, except for maybe Calvinists. You can imagine that they don't care about. There are no real angels in. And they are mentioned in the Bible, but Lutherans don't care about angels and anything or demons. It's like, oh, that's all just a metaphor. And now let's have a sermon about what this part of the Bible is supposed to stand for. So I don't really connect to the whole angel demon stuff. But it was really well done here. I liked it. I also liked that the narrator, they never knew who started this really bloody rebellion because they're fallen angels. They got thrown out of heaven for starting a rebellion. Lucifer, of course, was the first one, but there was a really bad rebellion. And the narrator later finds out that someone very close to her and who's doing everything to be a good person and help others was actually the leader of that rebellion, really bloody. And she's shocked, of course. Of course, that someone she cares about and who's so nice was involved in something so terrible. And yeah, it turns out that it simply was because she was always this crusading spirit. So yeah, it's just a story which simply works.
Yeah, you mentioned, and I wanted to talk about this, the concept that there were multiple falls, multiple cohorts of angels that fell, which it makes me want to know in the world building, what is wrong in heaven that is happening. And I liked the wistful things from the fallen about, you know, remembering the experience with, I think it's just called the light, and wishing they could get back. Go ahead, Sarah. I know you're right up against your deadline here.
There was one part in the story that I did really like. I don't want to give too much spoilers since we don't seem to be spoiling this one. But there's a part in the development of, what happens with the whole situation that is going on with, you know, the mystery and the demons and all. And there's a, from my religious upbringing and still somewhat religious leanings, there was just a part in it that I loved. You know, the whole story didn't stand for me, but there was one development in it that I really liked. Where I guess I can't say more without spoiling.
Oh, you can go for it. I don't so, mind. I mean, these are, you know,
so short, where everyone short fiction, is despairing, that they've lost, that the summoning circle is, you know, things are going very, very badly for the people on the ground. Mm-hmm. And She notices that talking about the light and the city is making the darkness go away a little. All their spells, all their rituals, that's not working for them, and they've kind of given up. But the narrator just notices that just talking about and remembering and believing that there is light. And she gets all the angels to be talking about the wonder and love. And I liked that, you know, that they were able to help themselves just by calling on the light. And I, as you know, as someone with still some, you know, murky undefined religious stuff, I liked the call, you know, the idea that no one is beyond help if they simply ask for it. Which that's certainly not going to work for everyone who reads the story, but for me, that felt clean and beautiful.
Go ahead, Cora.
Someone, I don't know who, like I said, I'm not a theologist and so on. I really don't know, but someone once said that, well, hell is the absence of God. And for these angels, hell literally is the absence. They live, the city is nice. It's a nice, okay, it has a slum and so on, but it's not, Star Hollow is not a bad place to live. But these angels, they're all longing for the heaven because literally for them, the absence of God and the absence of the light is hell. And also like the fact that when they called on the light or called on God, that they did receive help, even though they were fallen angels, so something really bad. That I also, like Sarah, also liked that bit.
Okay, any final thoughts on this one? Sarah, how much time do you have left? Just a few minutes, right?
So my sister Trish is handling some things for me. Okay. So I may have to go, but I think I can hang on for one more story.
Okay. All right. Any objections to moving on to the next one? If not, then we have The Pill by Meg Ellison, and Olav is doing our recapping duties.
So The Pill is a point of view story told in the first person about a young woman who is, she is larger, and so is the rest of her family. And her mom has an obsession with both weight loss and with taking radical cures through these test programs as a guinea pig almost. And she's tried these variety of ineffective weight loss techniques. And then one day there's the pill. And the pill allows people who are plus sized to lose 300 pounds in a couple of weeks. The downside is that there's a 10% mortality rate. And people are so obsessed with weight loss that this gets approved and becomes normalized. So as everybody is suddenly slimming down, the main character's mom has become a different person in some ways. But the main character's dad is one of that 10% who dies. And the main character is refusing to take the pill and trying to accept herself for who she is, for you know, loving her body, whatever shape it may be. And I think what really drew me to this story is how well observed it is, how thoughtfully it is constructed, and the societal commentary on our body image, our standards of physicality. There's a point in the story in which the main character is commenting on her brother's weight as part of her internal monologue, and says that she doesn't want to be one of those fat people. And just the fact that even though this character is on a journey towards accepting herself, she's still condescending towards other people and other people's appearance. I just thought that was a really amazing moment. And I'm going to give a spoiler alert. The story concludes with almost the entirety of society having eliminated people who are overweight from their from society. And the only safe place for the main character is a fetish reserve, I would call it, where, you know, this handful of large people can cater to the kinks of people who fetishize that form of beauty. So I think it's a story that just worked really well on a lot of levels.
Yeah, I wanted to, you were talking about the brother, and she was, as she's thinking of that, she says, "I acted like being fat was impolite, like burping. And the best thing to do was to conceal it behind the back of my hand and then always, always beg somebody's pardon." And I thought that was really, really a great turn of phrase. Go ahead, Sarah. Sorry, Olaf.
So I was just going to add on to that. There's another great turn of phrase where she's describing the family portrait and all of them in their brightly colored outfits. And the mom hides the picture, but the main character liked it because they were happy. And it's really cool that the author is really highlighting that somehow happiness has become secondary to image.
Go ahead,
Sarah. Yeah. So on right, that picture, that was a nice moment in it where, you know, he might have described them as colorful, happy beach balls or something along those lines. But mm-hmm. for her, it was okay that they were who they were. At least, certainly there were some feelings about, you know, but that person is too big. Yeah. And I see that happening. That does happen. One of the things that was the most interesting to me in the story is her repulsion at the people who take this pill. Their bodies all become alike. So all the same, you know, in most smaller people, we see a lot of variation in their bodies, their angles, and so on. But the way this pill worked, it really seemed to make it's like it had a template for a body and it was making everyone fit that body. And she felt repulsed by seeing all those bodies around her that were all the same, not just thin, but all the same. And she had a real reaction against that, as well as just the whole wanting to be happy with who she was, wanting to feel like there was nothing wrong with who she was and that it was okay to be happy and not have to wait until she was thin to be happy. You know, I've certainly seen so much advice to fat people of don't wear anything but black, you know, don't wear those bright colors, et cetera. There's a lot of that. And I liked her. Yeah, there was, I had my difficulties with the story, but I liked that she wanted to be happy as she was, and thought that there was nothing wrong with wanting to be happy with herself, not having to wait until she did something or had some achievement or got so right. X thin before she could be happy as a person.
Right. Well, and when you look at the results with the brother, right, it doesn't change his life at all. He ends up just going back to doing all the things that he used to do. It's just now he's uncomfortable hanging out with some of his D&D friends because some of them hadn't taken the pill yet. And this notion that somehow it's better to roll the dice on 10% mortality than to live as an overweight person. Yeah. Go ahead.
I think it was interesting because I work in healthcare. Not as a healthcare practitioner, but as an IT, but I see this a lot, the kind of unrealistic expectations against kind of like the actual consequences of reality and the impact on people's identity. So we still get people who think that they're wheeled in through the front door, that their legs chopped off, it's going to grow again. No. So, you know, I think there is a look, it's taken on that kind of theme within society, 21st century, that healthcare will provide a cure to all of society's ills. You know, a science, look, it's a pill that will get rid of prejudice, that will get rid of this. And no, I thought it, maybe from the point of view of the story, I thought it was fantastic. And I really, I felt a lot of empathy for the main character, and maybe also questions your own prejudices you have when you look at others. We do tend to judge whether we like it or not on people's appearance, etc. So I thought, yeah, the new norm where kind of obesity is outlawed just shows that if you, the minute you bring in something new, you get new problems and new prejudices come with it. So I really enjoyed it.
I think it's really interesting that this is a theme that Cory Doctorow actually played around with in his book Makers. There was a whole storyline about a similar treatment that allowed people radical weight loss. And I feel like Meg Ellison has tackled the theme more successfully. And I think possibly because she might understand it better. I mean, Corey is a very normative shaped guy. And I think this is a good example of why own voices writing is so important.
Definitely. I just realized I'm on mute, so it's hard for me to call on people. So Cora, why don't you go ahead?
Well, this one was actually the biggest surprise for me because I'd never read anything by Meg Ellison before. I hadn't read the story. It was not in a magazine. It was in an anthology, so I hadn't read it. And this one was, I was like, oh, what is it? The pill? Then, oh, something about weight loss, medical weight loss drugs. Oh, God, no. And I really wound up enjoying the story because it works. First of all, I have no doubt that if this pill existed, even with the high mortality rate, it would be approved and people would be taking it because there is this huge drive to have a normative body. Also, this is a second story about, body norms and norms, body norms and norms. Helicopter story was about gender norms. This one is about body norms and fat phobia. And I know these people who take people who are not maybe a little bit over, bit round, but they're not massively obese or something. But there's never been a silly crackpot diet they haven't tried. Oh, asparagus pills helps. Yeah, or what was it? Eat only rice helps, or whatever. It changes every couple of moments. I mean, in my lifetime, I've gone from someone who eats extremely healthy to someone who eats very unhealthy because I eat too many carbohydrates, which are now evil apparently. But I still don't eat a lot of fat simply because I get ill when I eat too much fat, so I have to be a bit careful. I know my body. But I know these people, and for these people who try every crackpot diet, like "you're fat" is pretty much the worst thing they can say. I have some relatives like that. And sometimes when they're mean to me, "oh, but you're fat," and I think, okay, you're idiot. Who cares what you think? And this is also why I like this. Why I like the narrator, because she learns to be fine with who she is, and she finds people okay. It's a weird fetish community, but she finds people who appreciate her for who she is. And also the fact that society pretty much forces people to take this very dangerous medication is also sadly something that I can believe, because I wouldn't be surprised if it had happened like that. This was the biggest surprise for me, a story I didn't expect to like, and that will probably wind up fairly high and on my board.
So I feel like the ending is a little bit sad in that she has given up her dreams of becoming a filmmaker. That's something that I did not love in the ending. But as you were highlighting, Cora, the story really is about how crazy society's body image obsession is. And I think one of the things that really worked for me in the story is just how cartoonishly awful taking this pill is. I mean, it's this horrible, painful, disgusting process of expelling mass from your body. It is cartoonishly extreme and so awful. And yet you can believe people putting themselves through that. You can believe a vast number of people putting themselves through it.
Yeah, one of the heartbreaking things in the story is the notion that the mom signs up for these clinical trials, because then she'll get to talk to someone who will listen to her. And that's, that's really sad. Juan, go ahead.
No, the one thing I wanted to talk, I really like the story. And actually, somehow Meg at some point put it free for award consideration. So I was kind of surprised. That's how I caught it. And I was lucky to I think this is a great story. Read it. I liked its world building, and it almost feels like old school science fiction. I would defer to Cor for this because I think she's a better historian than I am. But I think, you know, let's take one idea in society and run through it with modern sensibilities, because unfortunately, sometimes those old stories would be the characters would be flat. Two-dimensional, if you were lucky, I think, if I recall correctly. I mean, I remember reading the best of the Sprague de Camp and a very good mind, but I think he wrote a lot of stories which played around like this early in his career, if I recall correctly. But great work.
Go ahead, Cora.
Yeah, well, as Juan said, it is a bit of a... It does have this if this goes on feel. That was a thing in the 1940s, 50s. There were a lot of... I mean... Heinlein actually wrote one which was called If This Goes On, and they all take one aspect of society here. We wouldn't have had this story in the 40s simply because the weight loss obsession wasn't as huge. The weight loss obsession only it came in, I think, it came in sometime after World War II, especially at least in Europe. I know that a lot of people started putting on a lot of, they had gone through war and deprivation, also in the US, the Great Depression, and then and we had war rationing and food shortages during the war, after the war. And then in the 1950s, everything became available and they were eating and they were putting on weight, which is of course natural. Also, a lot of these people were having problems simply because their bodies had sort of adapted to very low calorie count, which is also why people who diet a lot, once they stop dieting, they just put on more weight. So dieting is actually a really harmful thing. And so this diet obsession came in the 1970s, 80s. So we wouldn't have had this story in the 40s, but it feels a bit like things like City or by Clifford D. Simak, or If This Goes On. And yes. And one thing I also noticed is that it's not just the people who are overweight who are taking the pill. It's people who are actually thin, whose bodies are perfectly normative, and they're still taking the bloody thing with the 10% of killing them, just because they might maybe one day put on weight. And okay, maybe they, if they really want to, they could take it then, but they just take it preemptively. And yeah, it's so crazy, but that's what people do. I mean, we have skinny teenagers dieting preemptively, which is just sad, but it's nothing, but it happens. And we have teenage magazines pushing diets on teenagers, which is also really terrible, but it's done. So yeah, as someone who dislikes, I was really, really skinny when I was young, and now I have a normal female body, I say, but I'm no longer skinny, but I'm not doing diets. And when I want chocolate, I bloody well eat chocolate. So yes, I met these diet obsessed people, and yeah, I can really, really believe this one.
Sarah, why don't you go ahead?
So the arc in this story is not a triumph. One of the saddest moments to me in the story is when this girl in college knows it's wrong to get into a car with a guy who she doesn't even know and go off with him to wherever he says. But she does it because this guy is talking to her like a human being. And she's so desperate for that. You know, she hasn't gotten much resiliency from her mother, you know, in life coping skills. And that, you know, yes, she drops out of film eventually because she doesn't really feel like she has anyone to make things for who'll be interested in what she has to say. And you know, I don't think she's necessarily right about that, but the way she's developed as a person and the way she's learned that people will and won't react to her, she just kind of gives up on that. And yeah, that kind of loneliness, that intense tiredness of being so alone, you know, I can definitely see why she did it, but But, you know, it to me is a sad story. You know, I'm glad she can be happy with herself, but to me, it is not a happy ending at all.
Mm-hmm. Ivor, go ahead.
I was just picking up what Cora was saying, and I was thinking back to the days of smoking, whereby it was once pushed as a cure for asthma, and now into the 80s, 90s, and the rise of smoking amongst young women, it's pushed as along the lines of suppressing your appetite, and it's good for that because it makes you look cool. Even now, it's still seen that with vaping. So it'll be interesting to see maybe a later short novella in the future whereby it's along the line, a novelette in the future where it says where the pill becomes bad for you and how people react to that. Mm-hmm. So by I can see correlations to modern day. So yeah, it's good.
Right, like margarine in the 80s instead of butter. Go ahead, Cora.
Yes, also, I think it was Sarah who said this, that the mother signs up for this trial simply so people will listen to her and actually pay attention to her. And this reminded me also of a relative, now dead, who was basically, she was a hypochondriac, and she always went to any doctor. There's a lot of these doctor-obsessed people. They clutter up doctor waiting rooms because they go to the doctor because the doctor listens to them, and they listens to them and pays attention to them. And in this case, it was a really sad case. Because this woman, they had private health insurance, and we have general health insurance in Germany, but the public, the state health insurance or the insurance doesn't pay for everything. Private pays for pretty much almost everything, and she had pretty much any kind of treatment you could imagine. And in the end, she got a likely unnecessary back operation. She had back troubles like everybody has. But she had an operation which likely was unnecessary, and in the end she was paralyzed and spent her last years in a care home. So it's a sad story, but the mother reminded me very much also, and this woman was also, let's say, body image obsessed. And after she was, she also, of course, she put on weight after she was wheelchair bound and was very troubled about this. So yeah, the mother reminded me, and also, yeah, the daughter is similar simply because she's also so desperate for someone to listen to her and talk to her that she even goes with this, well, kind of creepy fetish guy. Yeah. Also, about the filmmaking, I suspect she will eventually pick up a camera again and make maybe sort of movies in her weird fetish enclave for overweight people and people who like them. So she's thinking about making that movie. So I'm not sure she will forever give it up.
Yeah, the only thing there is she's restricted from publishing anything out to larger society about this enclave where she is. So, yeah, interesting story. Ivor, go ahead.
Sorry, it just dawned on me. It's been troubling me since I read this. I was thinking, I'm sure there's a society that tends to worship people who are big. And I was thinking, sumo wrestlers in Japan, mm-hmm. with the ceremony and the fact that obviously they're much bigger than the general population, but they are held in high status and adored. Even, you know, just because it just dawned on me that it's been troubling that for the past 2 days. It dawned on me. Sorry.
Yeah. Also, in some Asian societies, you just mentioned sumo wrestlers, but in some Asian societies, overweight people are still sort of adored. A co-worker of my dad's, he was working in China, and he was an overweight man, and he said all the people were touching him and rubbing him for good luck because at least in those days, it was like 20-30 years ago, in China, overweight still means this is a wealthy person, and they wanted to touch him to rub for the luck to rub off. And of course, also one joke they make, and it's a kind of mean racist joke, but let's say one thing they make in Germany, if a woman is overweight or curvy, they say, oh, but you can always get a Turkish guy because the Turkish guys like curvy girls. And so this whole thinness obsession is a very, very West. It's a Western thing. It's not, I think there's also, I forgot which, but there's a country in Africa where women are actually sort of fattened before they get married because the men want a bit curvy and chunky women. So thin women are not actually popular, and And so it is a very Western obsession, but of course the pill suggests that the whole world will eventually, because unfortunately the West does dominate pop culture, so the whole world will eventually start taking the bloody pill.
All right, anything else on this story, or we can move on to the final one? All right, let's go ahead and do that. Ivor, you have recapping duties for Two Truths and a Lie.
Okay, I have to turn the lights on because it's got dark now. Okay, right. Stella tends to lie. Back in town in her 40s to see her parents, she is asked by a childhood friend and former crush, I can't remember who I'm writing, I think it's Marco, to help clear his deceased brother's Denny's house. Denny's house is a hoarder's paradise of all the stir and mess that goes with it. In it, they find a tape with the 80s show of Uncle Bob's show, a creepy host who tells odd and horrifying stories to local children. Denny was in the audience, and later Stella finds out that she was too. As Stella further investigates Bob's stories in the background, it seems to be that they are prophetic and underlie their lives. And for Stella, it perhaps is all-consuming.
Nice. This one is creepy. I love it.
Mm. I would probably just add, I think it had very much a Ray Bradbury vibe. Mm-hmm. That kind of like from the off. And I loved it.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was good.
Yeah. Go ahead, Juan.
Well, one of the unique things about this, it was a little bit nostalgic. And I think, Seth, you might remember this because I think we're pretty close to the same age. It used to have all these local kids shows all over the country. I think every big mm-hmm. city. Oh, and Sarah, I don't know if you remember these shows that sadly were, for better or for worse, were phased out in the 80s because of commercial reasons. They weren't selling as many hamburgers as they used to, and that's what this reminded me. We had two in Miami, one which read the comics of a robot and another general Captain Kangaroo-like kid show, but a local host. And so that's what this reminded me. It was kind of interesting. I mean, the character Stella seems to be a compulsive liar. She's not lying for any particular reason. You know, she's not trying to get something. She's not trying to hide something. I thought that's what made this story very, very unusual. I will say this. This reminded me, I wrote this in my notes. Kids TV used to get away with being very creepy on a national level. It was kind of weird. I just saw some clips of, like, the Count was actually a little bit more creepy. He actually hypnotized Ernie and Bert so he could count blocks without being interfered with. And if you took a look at the original Mr. Snuffleupagus, somebody put the clip online and he had these bright yellow eyes. And I think that was, I repeated in the tweet, gee, I wonder when the team decided we should get rid of those eyes. I think they're freaking out the kids. So it just, that's what the memories, at least that this story brought with me.
Yeah. Go ahead, Sarah.
So the hoarding, first, this story to me is a flat out horror story. More than any of the others in the collection, really. The hoarding part is uncomfortable enough. It reminded me of the story Planet Fall by Emma Newman. That's a science fiction book. With a main character who you realize over the book is a hoarder, and it's partly because of some issues from before the book. But the other thing, the big thing to me was not so much the hoarding and the dealing with her parents' stuff and all, or sorry, I guess it was Marco's parents' stuff. Anyway, that, but it's the story and the story, the kids show where this guy who runs the show is picking out each kid and making them, maybe neurotic is the term about it, but it's like he's pushing them into some kind of pathology. And with the main character in the story, it's the lying. But he's done things to each of those kids on his show, or at least he's picked out kids on the show. And, you know, the whole thing of, you know, the parents keep sending them to the show. They don't realize, or they don't listen to the kids who may be uncomfortable with things. And there are, you know, friendly looking authority figures who do terrible things to kids, you know, in multiple ways, multiple vectors, and turning them into awful people sometimes. And the way this story goes with her, you know, kind of getting trapped back into this thing and telling herself she'll tell another lie, she'll make it better with another story. boy, that was a horror story to me for sure. I thought it was very powerful, very well done. I didn't like it at all. I think it's extremely well written horror.
Yeah. Cora, go ahead.
Well, it is a great horror story. And I love the nostalgic feel. I mean, I grew up in a different media environment. We also had weird shows for kids, but let's just say German kids TV was usually, it was very bland, very, very wholesome. Even something like Porky Pig was banned in Germany for a while because Porky Pig was, evil violence, Porky Pig. And when Sesame Street started up, at first now we have a local version of Sesame Street, which I never liked, not even as a kid. I said, I want my real Sesame Street. I didn't like the local one. I want Big Bird and I want my Snuffle Apple Gus. But the original one, there was a politician who screamed about, but this terrible show, it shows ghettos in the US. We don't want this. I said, wait a minute, Sesame Street is supposed to be a ghetto? No one ever told me this. It wasn't, I had seen, we lived on the Gulf Coast, and so I had seen those poor, predominantly black areas, but they didn't look like Sesame Street at all. And so I was like, okay, obviously the Bavarian politician has no idea of anything, which is clear, which is true. And so the nostalgia aspect, even though we didn't have this type of show, worked for me. And one thing I also liked was that after a while, this the narrator, she has problems telling apart what's a lie and what's the truth, and what is really, because she keeps telling lies. And false memories, which feel real, is something that happens. I didn't believe it, but I have a false memory, a fairly harmless one. It's not harmless, actually. When I was 7 or 8. There was, in my hometown, we had a floor dust explosion, which blew up a mill, I think killed 3 or 4 people. And I knew this mill because we drove past there when we visited friends of my parents. And so I knew the area, and I have a perfectly vivid memory of standing on the sidewalk and seeing this explosion happen. This memory is wrong. I was not on the side. Also, I know what dress I'm wearing. I feel the wind on my skin, but I know it didn't happen because the details are wrong. It's in my memory, I'm wearing a summer dress. The thing happened, I think, in January or February. I see the explosion happening at the wrong part, of the only part of the mill I could see from the road. There are daffodils blooming, and the daffodils obviously weren't blooming in February. So I know it's wrong, but I have this absolutely vivid memory. And for a while, when I had to, the first time I drove past that place on my own, I had a flashback in the car to a memory which never happened. So yes, false memories exist. And okay, remembering an explosion which happened, but which I never witnessed personally. Also, for a while, I thought I might have seen footage, but there is no video footage of this explosion. It happened in the middle of the night. There is no video footage. Just a perfectly vivid imaginary memory. So yes, it happens. And about this creepy kid show host, actually for a long time I expected it would be a kind of what's this British guy called, Jimmy Savile, the guy who did all these British shows and who then turned out to have abused like dozens or maybe scores of children. And I assumed it would be something like this, like this host is abusing the kids, but he is abusing them, but not in that way. So yes, great creepy story. The only thing which fell apart to me was a bit the ending, which was weak because it was like, okay, was kind of the ending was a bit weird, weak and vague, so I'm not quite sure what it was supposed to be.
Go ahead, Ivor.
I also take myself off mute. Okay, well, I'm in Britain, so we went out of our way to terrify our children, especially with our three channels up until the 80s. And to me, it didn't, a lot of the stuff that we got at school, maybe still do, is usually the lines of the unusual and perhaps more horrifying. But Sundays, 4:30, kid viewing time, we had Tales Unexpected by Roald Dahl. It's usually guaranteed somebody was going to get died or something horrible would happen to them. So I think that she's playing on the very much kind of like the paranormal, that sometimes good is also evil. within that story, because it resonated very much with me, like stuff that we got read when we were younger, but maybe not quite as complex. So I think maybe we're just like slightly dark and twisted over here. So
go ahead, Juan.
Well, the thing that just popped into my mind, the thing that I find a question that I have about this story is, did she create this whole show because she,
right?
I don't know if the show existed or not. Is it the chicken or the egg? Are we going into kind of like, and everybody correct me if I'm wrong, Philip K. Dick territory of what is real, what is not real. And, and that's why the ending kind of works for me, you know, on that level, because did she create this whole thing out of whole cloth, and how, and, you know, I guess the mystery of the thing, the fantastical element, is that somehow she had the ability to change reality, and then it causes the whole story to motivate. And I found that rather
popped into my head the first time I read it. I thought, because she says, right, I asked if he knew about the Mr. Bob show,
the Uncle Bob show,
That's right. And of course he hadn't, because no one had, it didn't exist. And then it turns out it does. And I thought, did she speak this into existence? But yeah, go ahead, Sarah.
So for me, the ending actually lined up a lot with Meg Ellison's The Pill, where the person has kind of let themselves and made themselves become trapped in a very limited world. I looked at it as magic realism. You know, I don't know if I was reading it right, but for me, that thing had happened. There had been a bad show host who was doing things to people, and she had, you know, she had been away. She was going to be able to get away, and now she was never going to leave. And so for me, the thing with the boy in the hill and her now kind of becoming the boy in the hill, you know, maybe it was the boy in the hill who had controlled the show host. It's all a little unclear, certainly. You know, there's sort of some dream logic going on in the story. So I'm not sure where, I suppose I could try and, you know, graph it out, but, you know, with, you know, circles and arrows and stuff. But for me, I guess I didn't feel like I needed to tie down exactly what had happened. It was a horror story. And so, you know, for me, you know, things were kind of inextricable and she was stuck. And however exactly it worked that she was stuck, part of it was she was sticking herself there. Mm-hmm. Part of which, because she'd been kind of manipulated into being that kind of person who would do that. Or maybe maybe the show host was picking up on issues within the kids already and just revving them up. So for me, I can certainly see that the ending is perhaps not completely coherent, but I don't think it's supposed to be, because it's a horror story. And I guess that's, you know, for me, that works for horror stories.
Well, and the story kind of talks about how Denny, the hoarder brother, kind of had rejected the prophecy that was spoken over him by Uncle Bob and gone the completely different direction. And now Stella essentially takes it and almost takes on somebody else's story.
Right. And was that reverse psychology on Denny? I don't know. Who knows? Yeah. It's hard to say. Or one of these strategists who, no matter which way they react, you've done what you wanted to because you've made things happen. And, you know, so.
Yeah. Go ahead, Juan.
Oh, no, I wanted to mention, I just remembered, and that's why you saw me turn my back. This is the one that won the Nebula, and I thought that was interesting that they picked a horror story this year. I mean, and you know, the more I think about it, I mean, the thing is, I've thought a bit more of the fantasy story, but the more I hear discussion about this story here and other places, I realize, it is a horror story. It just, I guess it's not the kind of like macabre or over the top horror story, you know, or graphic horror story. It's very subtle in its take and it's what it's trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Cora.
Well, I mean, horror has also been part of the Hugos for a long time. I think the first horror story that won was The Hellbound Train by Robert Bloch sometimes in the late 50s. So horror is, and of course, horror, fantasy, science fiction were not really separated for a long time. They ran in the same, Weird Tales published all threes, and there's this wonderful editorial from a very early Weird Tales where Otis Adelbert Klein is trying to explain, this is what we're publishing without using the words horror, fantasy, science fiction, because none of these words had yet been coined. So it's fascinating. So horror is part of the genre. But I think this one would, if this story had appeared in a more, in a horror market, if it had been in The Dark or Nightmare magazine scene or maybe a horror anthology, then probably it would have been up for the Stoker Award. But it was an Uncanny. Uncanny is
It's Tor. It's Tor magazine.
Oh, yeah. For some reason, I always keep mixing up that was actually look at Uncanny for the story and something like, why can't I find it? Because it's Tor. But yes, Tor is even more of a core. Okay, Tor publishes horror, of course. They have what's called Nightforge, or they have a horror imprint. But Tor.com are very much horror genre.
If we're talking early connections to the Hugos, because you said the first horror that had won the Hugo was That Hellbound Train, which, correct me if I'm wrong, That Hellbound Train was 1958?
Sounds right. Like
that. Yeah, I actually think Twilight Zone was starting right around the same time, and of course it won three Hugos, I think back-to-back, as a series. And this story kept reminding me of a good Twilight Zone episode, not one in particular, but the themes that Serling returned to repeatedly, which were, you know, these very nostalgic, very focused on his own childhood parables or even morality plays. And so the lying, the looking back on the childhood, that all just tied into that that Twilight Zone-ishness of this story.
Yeah. Sarah, why don't you go ahead and it looks like you need to get moving.
Yeah. So I just wanted to say how much fun it was discussing this with everyone, exchanging views and perspectives. If people want to reach out to me, I'm on Twitter at Configures. I thought this was a good batch of stories. I still keep moving around a little bit which one I'm gonna put as the finalist.
I've reordered my list like three times already during the discussion.
Yeah. Yeah. Like the short stories that we talked about previously, there's different strengths and weaknesses in these stories. I'm very happy that there were so many different types of entries in the novelette finalists. I was glad to see that. I thought they stood up well to rereading or re-listening, depending on how I'd first experienced them. Hmm. So thanks, everybody.
Yeah. Thanks, Sarah. Okay. Olav, it looked like you need to take off as well.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I think this was a really great novelette shortlist. It's actually, I think, one of my favorite categories this year, just in terms of overall quality. And I'm pretty dead set on what's at the top of my ballot, but there's a lot of good stuff here.
Yeah.
And,
I have a question for Olaf before he leaves, and it's related to this last story. I'm curious, does Canada have regional TV or is it just national TV? I was curious if you had shows like this up north or were you even in Canada as a child?
Yes, I was in Canada most of my childhood. And yes, we did have regional TV shows. We don't so much anymore.
Did you have these type of shows that I was discussing and was discussing the story? I'm just curious.
Well, my internet was cutting in and out, but from what I heard, I think we did have a show in Calgary that was relatively similar to this. And of course, local wrestling.
Of course. Okay.
Okay. Thanks very much.
Yeah. Thanks for being here, Olaf. Ivor, I think you had something you wanted to say.
Yeah. I wanted to basically blame science fiction for actually pulling me towards horror. because I've only started picking up science fiction in the past few years, and I've noticed that I'm quite keen on the horror ones, and I'm quite keen on the fantasy and the grimdark stuff that's coming, that I keep discovering because of people keep publishing podcasts and magazines and stuff. And maybe it says something of the reader that we do want to be challenged. But actually going back to the original story about reality, because my thought process was basically that Stephen King was the thing that we all touch on when we're a teenager. And I found some of his horror stories were about changed realities. There was nothing horrific about them, no gore, just basically a changed reality. So I just wanted, this will come out, and I blame you all.
Sounds good. All right, let's move towards final thoughts. And people, if you want to rank some stories, you can. Cora, you had your hand up. Go ahead.
Just about the weird children's shows. We did have, it was on National German TV. It was called Spaß am Dienstag. Fun on Tuesday. And it showed just short films, cartoons and so on. And there was a host, was a kind of young, hip guy, like 1980s hip guy. But he had a companion, and that was an electronic effect. It was like a worm. It was like a dot which moved around the screen. And actually, come to think of it, they revived that effect later on for a comedy show where this it was called Sini, this worm. And that Sini was really, really rude and always insulting the host. And so come to think of it, Sini was, of course, really creepy. And I mean, the Muppets could be really, they were really adult at times, the Muppets. I mean, they had Village People songs and did one clip, which is basically the Muppets doing the Stonewall riots with the pigs and Gonzo being the gay people and throwing flower pots at Fozzie Bear, who is the police. And of course, this went totally over every child's head, but it was, so kids' TV used to be edgy. Also, yeah, about horror, one thing I've noticed that the horror movies, at least now we're having better ones like Get Out and Us and so on, but Midsommar and what's it all called, but for a while, horror movies were just like, oh God, teenagers are having sex and getting slashed up by weird masked killers. And that's, of course, like, say, it does a disservice to the horror genre. There's an audience for that sort of thing. I have not been that audience for a long time, but I do like that we're getting more horror elements. And also, yeah, you have to rediscover the better horror that we used to have and that sort of fell by the wayside also due to too many sensationalist, bad Stephen King copies in the 1980s, 90s.
Nice. Okay, before we lose everybody, Ivor, I saw you had your hand up, so I'll let you clear that first. Oh, go on. Okay. Let's go ahead. And I do want to mention to anybody watching this, last time when we introduced Cora, I mentioned that she's a Hugo finalist, and Olav is as well. He mentioned it as well. So I'll make sure to put links in the description and in the show notes for this to Cora's work and to Olav's work over on the Hugo Book Club. Fantastic stuff over there. Summing up, I'm going to go ahead and say my top three, I think, are The Pill, Two Truths and a Lie, and The Inaccessibility of Heaven. I'm not sure what order yet. I'll figure it out. I may enter it once and change it later. Who knows? But Ivor, why don't you go ahead and give yours if you have them?
Seth, you've been copying my homework. mine are The Pill and Inaccessibility of Heaven, just purely because it's gone up to number two because of the quality of the writing, and Two Truths and a Lie.
Nice. How about you, Juan?
I definitely know The Pill is my number one. Right now, I don't have my ballot. I finished it. I try to do it on the first impressions because if I think about it too much, you're going to be going all over the place. So just go with your gut feeling. And that's my recommendation for anybody who's reading this, putting their ballot together.
Okay.
Because it's a challenge. But it's a more, I believe, the Australian balloting system, which we use, is a more fair system.
Yeah. Yeah, I like it. What about you, Cora?
Well, my top two are Monster and The Inaccessibility of Heaven, and below that, it's basically a battle between The Pill, Two Truths and a Lie, and Sam Byrne, or the episodic life of Sam Wells as a super. The only one which doesn't work for me is the helicopter story. All others, I mean, in any year, either of them could have been my number one. Where this is an extremely strong novel that year. One of the, I think the very strongest was 2019, when every single novelette was good. good, but at least for me, that was the strongest year. But this is a really, really strong year for novelettes. And even the helicopter story, it's not bad. I'm just not the audience for it, which is okay.
Alrighty, well, thank you everybody for showing up to do this and for working with the scheduling. I had hoped we'd get a couple more people in here, but I dropped the ball on that one. So I will try to circle back. If I do another one of these, I'll get more people on. So thank you to anybody who watched or listened. You know, leave a comment. Let us know what your favorites were as well. So thank you. Any final things that anybody wants to say, Juan?
No, just... I'll reiterate because I just looked up what my Twitter account actually is. It's at Rainbow War 71.
Okay. Any contact info for you, Ivor?
No, I just exist and I read and I occasionally appear on these podcasts. It has been a pleasure, an absolute pleasure. Thank you. Excellent.
It's great having you. Thanks for coming back.
Yeah, same thing. It's great being here, Seth.
Yeah. All right, Cora, I know you've got a link you want to give out.
Yes. First of all, thanks for having me. And if you want to read my fan writing, you can find me at corabulot.com. That's corabulert.com. And also, for those who are Hugo voters, please don't neglect the fan categories. We have a long reading period right now. And I know that the four fan categories, that's fan writer, fan artist, fan scene and fan cast, they get less votes than most of the other categories and sometimes are in danger of not being awarded at all. So, yeah, you don't have to vote for me. You don't have to vote for Olaf and the Hugo Book Club blog. So they do great work. So please look at, but just take a look at what's all the good work that the fan writers and fan casters and fan scene, the fan artists are doing, because here you have a lot of people doing excellent work and great genre commentary for pretty much little to no pay. And yeah, this is really the heart of the genre. And even though we have a lot of great fiction on the ballot and great shows, just, okay, if you're a Hugo voter, don't neglect the fan categories, please.
100%. Agreed. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening or watching. Bye.